F1. Number 26A.
Now we go to the fourth subject, and here again, that sense of approaching God as a principled idea is being brought out. It begins by saying, well, you know, there is one Father and there is one God that has created us. There is one God and one Father, one principle of the universe, of heaven and earth. But he asked them, well, have you really been faithful to this one God? See, now principle is always that which demands obedience and faithfulness. Have you been faithful to that one God? And he tells them, well, you see, Judah has dealt treacherously. Judah has profaned the holiness of the Lord. Judah has married the daughter of a strange God. See, they have left the true faith towards one principle, have been unfaithful, have dealt treacherously. They have married the daughters of other gods. They have married themselves to all sorts of systems and ideologies and isms and ologies and so on. They have married inwardly themselves to many other ways of thinking and of metaphysics. And he goes on and says, well, have you really been faithful to that one God? Because if you are unfaithful to men, you are also unfaithful to God. And he uncovers in them their unfaithfulness towards men, towards ideas. Why do we deal treacherously, every man against his brother? Thou hast dealt treacherously against the wife of thy youth. It's always very important that we never deal treacherously against the wife of our youth, to lose our first love. That's very dangerous. And it is an argument and a claim that so easily tries to creep in on our consciousness. Each one of us has had time when we came to this idea, and a time when just something big seems to light up itself in ourselves, or just we had a touch of the bigness and of the light and the greatness and the magnitude of it, and has inspired us. But then, as we go on, a sense tries to creep in which wants to take away that adoration of this idea, the joy of this idea, seeing the bigness of this idea. And then we lose the wife of our youth. And that's a pity. In our work we have to be very careful that we keep up the love to that wife of our youth. Very careful. And I feel that what Mrs. Eddy saw when she instituted those lesson sermons was, among others, that she wanted each one to be at this idea every day. Because she knew it only takes 2 or 3 days and it can fade out, you see. It can take away the whole joy of it. And each one of the workers knows that if we only let loose for a few days, that we just feel something is crumbling away, that the original joy and happiness and expectancy is fading. So he asks consciousness to always be faithful to principle and to principle's idea, to revivify, can you say revivify? Yeah. Revivify constantly the adoration of what science is, of what science will do for the world, how big it is, how important it is, how fundamental it is, so that that love for that wife doesn't fade. That's so important. He says, because an unprincipled mentality, a mentality which is not wedded neither to God nor to its idea, can never demonstrate principle, because it's not whole. Ye have covered the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping, and with crying out. You know, we know that. We know that religious, good religious sense, to a certain extent, good religious sense, which is able to repent, and then, instead of going forward to principle, just cries on the altar, just weeps on the altar, just sheds the tears on the altar. Instead of going forward and say, well, what does happen when I am cast down and approach God with that sense of being cast down? I am not wedded to the true idea. Or I would rejoice and I would see the bigness and there would be joy instead of weeping. And so all the crying and the weeping and so on, they have to a certain extent, a beneficial influence. It somehow relieves the human mind, somehow. So I'm not against it. I like when a patient comes to me, just cries its heart out. I feel, well, I have already won the battle. Because it relieves the person when they once can get it out of their system. But, and then usually thought is more ready and more ready to think again, peacefully and quietly and with more neutral and rational sense. But then principle asks, you see, to be wedded to the idea, to be wedded to principle, and appear before the Lord as a principled idea, not as a weeping idea, if that would be possible. You see, being cast down and so on. So, he says, well, a man must seek a godly seed. A godly seed. He must be a principled idea. That's how he must stand before principle. He mustn't stand before principle in any other way than like principle. Therefore, as a principled idea. And not as a person and with a personal problem and a personal sense. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. Again he comes with that wife of his youth. Let none deal treacherously against the wife of your youth. That love for the idea must always be renewed and renewed. A constant honeymoon with the idea of principle. That's what is needed. Where we just joy over the idea constantly and constantly. And then we keep it alive and intact. Then he goes to a fifth argument. An argument that comes up here and there. The argument which says, after all, they said, I really come to the conclusion that God doesn't exist at all. So, God had to deal with that argument. Where they said, well, really, it doesn't really matter. It's all humbug. Really, there is no God. It's no God. He really doesn't care, and if he is, he doesn't really care for people. The argument was that there is no God who will come and judge, that you can do just what you like. They say, everyone that doeth evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delighteth in them. Or they say, well, where is your God of judgment? They say, you see, today so often you hear this argument. They say, now look into the world, how injustice reigns. It's not true what you people say, that God is a judge and that he actually lives and comes and does his job and puts things right and punishes the unjust. He does not live because you can see that he does not judge. So the Lord said, now listen. He said, I will tell you something. I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. And he shall suddenly come. See, he shall suddenly come. Because the life is always ready to spring into action when the time is ripe for the solution. He shall suddenly come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in, behold, he shall come. See, the argument was, he is not coming. There is no God. And so he begins to say, now wait here, he is coming. God is life and he is coming. And then he says, you know, only that which is of the nature of life then can endure that coming. All else that is not of the nature of life in you, which is not like life in you, is going to be destroyed. Life, so to say, is irresistible. For he is like a refiner's fire. He is a refiner and purifier of silver and gold. I will come near to you to judgment. I will be a swift witness against. And then he shows how he will be a swift witness against the sorcerers, the adulterers, the false swearers, and against the oppressors and the hirelings, against the oppressors of widows and the fatherless and so on. You see, just the whole list of showing that there is judgment, that God is, that he is an actual fact. And that nothing can withstand that life in its purifying activity except that which is of the nature of life. So he shows that life preserves really only that which can stand the purifying process. And so says, you see, only that can appear before God which can stand the fire of God. Only that really can exist eternally and stand eternally, which is of nature of life, because life will just wipe away like a refiner's fire all that is not of the nature of everlasting identity and existence. Then when he has shown that argument, he comes to a sixth truth. And here it shows first that God is a fact, an unchangeable fact, and that what must be changed is not God, but man. And so everything turns around man. For I am the Lord, I change not. But you, sons of Jacob, have not departed from your iniquities. He shows now mortal manhood. He argues with them and says, I'm all right. Says, I'm all right. Don't say I let you down. Don't say I don't do the job. If you can't see the fruits of your life, well, it's because you have not seen your true manhood. It's not my fault. I'm true. And I'm truth. And so he uncovers the deceitful manhood. Ye are gone away from mine ordinances and have not kept them. Ye have robbed me. And then they ask, what do you say? We have robbed you. See? I said, yes, you have robbed me. He answers them right back. It's always a conversation, you see, that always goes around making it clear that human mentality always thinks they are serving God. He doesn't deal with a mentality which says, We don't want to have a God, and we don't believe in a God, and so on. It's dealing with a mentality which serves a God, but which have a false sense of serving God. A false sense of serving God. So the Christ must come and argue with us. And he argues with us to the point where we begin to see first that we are not approaching God as God's image and likeness. And then, having uncovered that, he shows that if we do, that we will always have the benefits of God. And so he said, yes, ye rob me. Ye rob me in tithes and offerings. This whole nation, he has said, has robbed me. Says, this whole nation has never brought me the real tithes. The tithes, you know what it is, the tenth that they had to offer to God. So, he said, I know you. I know. You always say, he said that to Israel, he said, yes, I know you. You say, yes, we have to bring in the tithes. And we know that we owe something to God, and you say, yes, we are grateful to God, but are we really showing that gratitude, or are we half-hearted about it? That's what he's telling them. He said, you rob me. And how do they rob God? Well, after all, one can't rob God, so to say. God is what he is. He isn't dependent on if people take away something from him or not. That can't be possible. But he shows, you see, that we rob God in if we don't bring in our wholeness to God, because we don't get anything back from God. That we rob God in that way, that God doesn't demonstrate itself then to human consciousness. That we don't get our demonstrations. And it's always, I always see and see again and again that those people who cannot give their tithes according to their abilities, according to their faculties, according to their specific human situation, that somehow they never make progress. They love science, and they like science, and they say, I owe everything to science, but they can't make progress because they don't give their tithes. Why can't they make progress? Because if they don't give their whole, always the whole, according to every specific situation in which in spiritual development each one is. So one can't say each one has to give the same thing. It's always different from each one. The one can give this and the other one can give that. But it's always that thing which says, do we leave anything in our consciousness which serves another purpose? Do we leave time and energy and so on, and abilities and faculties and whatever we may have to serve a purpose? Do we distract some of it for a purpose which doesn't matter, which is not going to serve the biggest we know? It's always the biggest we know. Some have a sense that the Red Cross is the biggest they know, so to serve the Red Cross. Some think this and that is the biggest they know, so they serve them. But here it comes to the point where he says to Israel, you know inwardly that God is the biggest, that truth is the biggest, that the idea of science is the biggest. But are you wholehearted in it? Or are you just saying, yes, I'm grateful, I owe everything to it, and I wouldn't be alive anymore with it, I couldn't do it anymore with it, I wouldn't like to live anymore without it. And then he comes, but do you not rob me? And so he says, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house. And then he shows, you see, he shows, if we go wholeheartedly to God, then God can hear us. Then God can pour out his riches on us again. And prove me now herewith, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall be room, that shall not be room enough to receive it. So, many of you remember how John Dolly used to say, it's the little extra that matters. You remember that?
Yes.
It's always the little extra that matters. Because if we always can just do a little bit more than what we ordinarily would do, we begin to use that law of truth, which says, now I have then already given some more of my tithes to the Lord. And that always brings back another blessing. Then next time we can already do a little bit more again, a little extra again, which we ordinary way wouldn't have done. And the law again comes into action that it brings back to us. So he says, all right, I will just open the windows of heaven and pour out a blessing that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And this is a law, I think, which each one of us has experienced and experienced over and over and over again. Just always that law which says, well, if we say that we are grateful for God, but don't put the whole into it, what we can, only what we can, we never need to do more than what we can. That is never asked. It's only asked to give the tithes, that which we can part with. Can part with in energies, in love, in time, in adherence, in joy, in whatever it is. Each one has something to give, or he wouldn't be man. He wouldn't be man. And the more we begin to realize how much we can give in the way of all these various ideas in the spiritual, on the human plane and on the material plane, it always includes all the three. Then we give our time to it, our energy to it, our love to it, our patience to it, our humility to it, all that, and give to it. Always a little bit more than what we usually would do. And it brings down the blessing from heaven. So when he had corrected that, he goes to the last subject, love. When they had a new argument with the Lord Almighty, they said, well, more or less they said, well, it's in vain to serve the Lord. So the Lord said to them, ye have said, it is vain to serve the Lord. Ye have said, what profit is it that we have kept his ordinances? Because they say, they reason, they that work wickedness are set up, yea, they that tempt God are even delivered. So what's the use of serving him? And so he shows and says, well, look here. What happens to those that serve and fear the Lord? So he takes those that came and feared the Lord. And the Lord said to them, they shall be mine. And I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serveth him. He says, those that fear the Lord, it's always a sense who love God, for them the Lord loves his idea, never loses sight again of loveliness, never loses sight of its idea. So the difference then is brought out in the next verse between those that do serve God, the wicked, that do not serve the God, the wicked, and those that serve God, the righteous. And he says, to those that do not serve God, he says, how the proud and the wicked shall be burnt up, so that neither root nor branch is left of them. I feel that nothing is really left of anybody in the world, really left, who has not served the Lord. that they are being rooted out by root and branch, that just nothing is left. If we think back, say, in the time of the prophets, in time of Israel, how only really out of that whole big empire that has stood as substance what the spiritual seers saw and did. And all the others, one, the big boys, the kings and the princes and all those people who were the captains and the generals and everything, they are just written as names somewhere on a stone, and the historians talk about it, so they have something to do. But we have nothing of them. We have no substance of them. The branch of them, you see, is not alive. We have gained nothing of, say, Ashurbanipal and his victories. What have we gained of him? He was such a mighty king of Babylon. But what have we gained? What have we gained if we are troubled? What have we gained if we are sick? What have we gained if we are in fear? Neither the root nor the branch has done anything to them. But those spiritual seers like Jeremiah or like a Micah or so, see, who served the idea and who planted an idea and who watered an idea, they are still alive. Their root is not rooted out and their branches have not withered. They're still alive. They're still alive right where we are, you see. The leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nation. They are still alive. When I now, after 2,500 years, are in trouble and some cloud seems to come over me, I still can go to my brother Jeremiah and say, "Oh boy, I'm so glad you are alive. You help me." And he says, "Oh yes, I help you. You know what I am. And I can go through Malachi." And he's alive. So really what he says here at the end, you see, is, yes, the proud and the wicked. The proud and the wicked, because somehow the human mind always has some adoration or valuation of the proud and the wicked. The proud who has done something in the world. A big general, a big politician, a big industrialist who has built up a factory. Yes, they are workers, they have done something. And so we are always a bit adoring, would you say adoring them, or admiring them. And the wicked too, we say, "Oh, those Hitlers and those Mussolinis and those this and those that, without Neros and so on." We talk about them. What have they done? And yet we think, "My God, they really made a noise, and we can't make a noise." But when it comes down to rock bottom, you see, then we say, "Well, what have they done? What is there real substance or not left?" No, the root is rooted out and the branches are withered. It's burnt up. It's left nothing of them. Only ideas remain.